Believe in yourself, cause it starts with you, and then everyone else will believe you too. And if it looks like you're the only believer around, just keep on believing, don't put yourself down, just believe.
Our guest this week grew up in Jamaica, New York, and earned a BS, an MS, and a JD from the University of Notre Dame. A triple domer. He worked for DTE from 1994 through 2011 and rose to be its chairman and CEO. He then joined PG&E, California's largest utility, as its chairman, CEO, and president. One of the most respected community leaders, his name, Tony Earle. And we're honored to have him as our guest. And I'm Jack Rasula, and this is Anything Is Possible on News Talk 760 WJR. I'm Jack Rasula. This is Anything Is Possible, and we're talking to Tony Earle, Chairman, CEO, and President of PG&E. Tony, welcome. A real honor to have you.
Well, thank you, Jack. It's great to be on with you.
Can we start by talking about your childhood and your mom and your dad?
Well, I'd love to. I mean, I had a great childhood. Grew up in Long Island in New York. I'm one of six kids. I have three sisters and two brothers. My mom and dad are still alive. They're 91 and 88. And as you can imagine, with six kids, none of us more than 15 months apart, it was a pretty wild household growing up. My mom had a great theory that if she kept us busy in sports, we couldn't get into trouble. So we always had something going on. It was a lot of fun. We still get together and have a great time with the whole family.
What's the biggest thing you learned from mom, and what's the biggest thing you learned from dad?
Well, from my mom, I learned that it's okay to be smart and do well in school. My mom is one of the smartest women that I have ever met. She attended MIT in the 1940s during World War II, and I don't think there were more than one or two women there. And then, of course, got married, had kids, didn't work for a while. In fact, didn't work at all until she went back and in her 50s got her MBA and finished first in her class. And I can remember when I was in college, you remember the old TV show College Bowl? And it's where they ask these very difficult questions and the college students would have to answer them. Well, I was at a Notre Dame football game. They were visiting me, and after the game we're in somebody's room, and College Bowl is on. And as they're answering these questions, there's a voice over on the side of the room kept popping up with the answers. Well, after about three or four of these things, people stopped talking and started looking at it. There was my mother, after three bars of some Beethoven symphony, could tell you exactly what it was. So, I mean, she really impressed us with the need to do well in school, do your best at something you really like.
Speaking of Notre Dame, you earned a BS, an MS, and a JD there. And they say, Tony, that you don't graduate from Notre Dame. You become Notre Dame. What do they mean by that?
You know, it's the culture there, and, you know, it's hard to explain. But it's not only earning a degree and learning how to do a particular skill. It's about how you act as a person. It's really focusing on others and the community. And you're exactly right. You never get away from Notre Dame. I know many people who graduated from Notre Dame as undergraduate on to graduate programs elsewhere, but they always have this deep connection with the university.
Tony, how was it you went on to join the Navy?
Well, it's really partly because of my dad. And you ask, you know, what did I learn from my dad? Over the years, my dad has been a great role model and advisor because our careers had some parallels. He was a naval officer during World War II. Then started in law school. Now, he never finished law school because those kids were coming down every 14 or 15 months. Going to night school wasn't going to work for him. But he became an executive in a large company, Burlington Industries. And so over the years, he's been able to give me great career advice, but also, you know, how you ought to treat people. So my dad, very successful executive, but I can honestly say I don't think I've ever heard him say a bad word about an individual. About the most he'll say is, oh, you know, Jack, I just don't care for that individual. Or, you know, he's not my cup of tea. And that was about as bad as it would get. And so I learned from, no matter how many clashes you had with individuals, no matter how many differences, you really needed to treat them with respect, and that was a great learning. And so I saw him and his experiences from the Navy. He used to tell great stories. I mean, he's 21 years old. He was involved in the invasion of Italy and also in the invasion of southern France, commanding a landing craft. And so that kind of piqued my interest. And I was in college during the middle of the Vietnam War. And so at the time, when you graduated from college, you knew you were going to serve in some military. And I thought, well, I might as well pick something I like. And I was fortunate to get a Navy ROTC scholarship, and I went to Notre Dame on a Navy ROTC scholarship.
You served 5 years in the Navy, and you served as the chief engineer officer aboard the USS Hawksbill, a nuclear sub. What's it like being in a sub at the bottom of the ocean?
Well, Jack, it was a fascinating, life-changing experience. The whole Navy experience really gave me the skills that I use almost every day in my job. I mean, I spent 5 years on active duty. I'd spent 4 years as a Navy ROTC midshipman, which meant every summer you would go and get experience in some aspect of the naval service. I can remember as I was an 18 or 19-year-old midshipman third class, standing ready to walk up the gangplank of a World War II destroyer, the USS Putnam, and being scared to death. I had no idea what I was doing. And yet 4 years later, when I graduated and was commissioned an ensign, I had the self-confidence and the knowledge to be successful as a naval officer on a nuclear submarine. The Navy, you know, had great training. I mean, you'd learn naval tactics, you'd learn naval history, but they always coupled that with leadership lessons. And it's those leadership lessons that I have found incredibly valuable over the years. But I used to describe my submarine experience as hours and hours of boredom followed by moments of sheer terror. Because remember, I was in the service from active duty in the service from 1971 to 1976. The Cold War was raging. I spent much of my time monitoring Soviet fleet exercises, and you'd be there for hours and nothing would happen, and then all of a sudden something would happen and you'd have to track what was going on, and you'd find yourself in the middle of a Soviet torpedo exercise at night, thinking, if I mess this up, I probably start a major international incident. I better pay attention to this stuff.
We're talking to Tony Earley, and I'm Jack Rasul, and this is Anything Is Possible on News Talk 760 WJR. Welcome back to Anything Is Possible. I'm Jack Rasul, and we're with Tony Earley, who spent 5 years at Long Island Lighting Company. Tell us about that chapter in your life, Tony.
Well, that was one of those career twists that you don't plan, but in hindsight, it was an incredible experience. Now, after I got out of the Navy, I went to law school, and I was practicing with a large firm in Richmond, Virginia, Hunton and Williams, and I was doing energy-related work and was doing licensing work for a nuclear plant that was being built on Long Island, the Shoreham Nuclear Plant. It happened to be hugely controversial at the time. It was a period when there were protesters outside the gates periodically. Very complex licensing process. Ultimately, the then governor of New York, Mario Cuomo, came out opposed to the plant. So as you can imagine, it was pretty contentious. And sort of two or three years after I had started doing work as outside counsel for the company, I got approached to be general counsel of the firm and join the company. The then general counsel was at retirement age and I think was kind of worn out with all the legal battles and wanted to retire to Florida. And so I took the job and I felt pretty good about myself. I was 35 years old. I was general counsel of a Fortune 500 company. And then when I got to the firm, I was rifling through some files that the former general counsel had left me and discovered that at least three or four high-powered New York lawyers had turned the job down because they were convinced the company was going to go bankrupt in the next 6 months over this nuclear battle. But we managed to work through the issues, license the plant, and then in a twist of fate, the state of New York said, well, we really don't want it to operate, and we negotiated a deal to sell it to the state of New York, and they shut down the nuclear plant. Then we were able to move on with providing power to the rest of our customers on Long Island. My boss said, hey, you did a pretty good job navigating through all that. How'd you like to be president of the company? And so then I spent the 5 years that I was president of the company trying to rebuild relationships that had been frayed by this long, contentious battle over a nuclear power plant. It was relationships with the regulators, relationships with politicians, and relationships with our customers. My focus there, and it's been my focus at other companies that I've since worked for, is to provide really great gas and electric service to customers, and eventually customers will notice that.
How was it, Tony, you joined DTE in 1994?
Well, I guess I had developed some reputation as having turned around the customer relationships on Long Island after this contentious battle over a nuclear plant. And I was called by a recruiter who was searching for a president at DTE Energy, then Detroit Edison, in Detroit. And I can tell you, when I first got the call, I probably had the same reaction any New Yorker has actually anywhere outside of New York. The view, I think, of many New Yorkers is there's really nothing west of the Hudson River worth knowing about. But I did travel to Detroit and met with John Lobia, who was then the CEO, and fell in love with the community, fell in love with the company. Although John, I think, thought I would never take the job because I was being given a tour of the town by a woman who ran a corporate relocation firm, Jill Damaris, who's now passed away. But Jill was a wonderful woman and a wonderful advocate for Detroit. And as she said, she was going to show me the good, the bad, and the ugly in Detroit. And, of course, we saw the Grosse Pointe and went to Bloomfield Hills and Birmingham and all kinds of other great places. But we also went into Detroit. And I can remember I was supposed to have lunch with John, and I wasn't going to be able to make it. The tour was just taking too long. And I called him and said, John, is it okay if we cancel the lunch and we can get together at some other time? And he said, that's fine. Where are you? And I told him where I was, and it's what is now the site of the Milliken State Park, which you'll recall had some cement silos and rubbish, and it was not a very pretty place back in 1994. And I thought he was going to have a heart attack. He said, you are where? But I saw the potential, and I'm so pleased now that the riverfront has been developed as a great resource for Detroit. And I think back to that day 20 years ago, and I didn't imagine that it would develop the way it has, but I'm pleased that it's been successful.
And we're a better community because of your coming here. Tony, take us back to August 14th, 2003. Where were you and what happened?
Boy, that, Jack, that day, I still remember it like it was yesterday. So I'm sitting in my office late in the afternoon, and all of a sudden the lights in the office kind of flicker a couple of times, and then the lights go out. And as luck would have it, there actually was some maintenance work going on the floor below us. So I called out to my executive assistant and said, Bernadette, tell them to stop fooling around with the lights down there, and I got a meeting going on. And just about that time, one of our vice presidents walks into my office and said that his wife had just called him from home in West Bloomfield and said the power was out. Of course, this was a perfectly sunny day. It was kind of strange, but every once in a while you do have those outages. And then another minute later, and another officer of the company came in, and his wife had called from Ann Arbor and said the power was out in Ann Arbor. Well, I knew that on a sunny day, it powers out in Ann Arbor, powers out downtown Detroit, and powers out in West Bloomfield all at the same time, we have a big problem. And as you recall, of course, that was only 2 years after 9/11, and everyone was still skittish about what might happen, and we realized we had lost our whole system. All 2.5 million electric customers were dark. And while that is an exercise that every utility plans for and practices, it's one you hope you never see. And we were seeing it. Immediately walked down to our emergency headquarters, kind of started to get the reports in. And in fact, what happened is the system blacked out. A number of our power plants are trying to supply power to keep the whole eastern seaboard up. And so we had damage to some of our power plants. And as we sat there trying to assess the damage, you think about, so we've practiced this, but how do we get this system back up? And how do we get this economy and infrastructure running as quickly as possible? And I can remember somebody saying to me, said, well, Tony, we've got to explain to the public what has happened. And it's at that moment, as a leader, you decide, well, you've got to step up and really get in front of your organization. And so shortly thereafter, we went out in front of the DTE building and held a press conference. And I can remember walking out and seeing probably half a dozen sound trucks with their booms up, a row of microphones, and we had set up kind of a impromptu press conference. And I can remember Martin Taylor, who ran our government affairs organization, as we're walking out, and he could tell I was probably a little nervous. Not only did we have a blackout, but I had this whole big press entourage there wanting to talk to me. And Marty leaned over to me and said, hey, Tony, don't be nervous. No one's going to hear you. No one's got any electricity. And, of course, that relaxed me, and over the next 48 hours, probably did five or six of those press conferences, as DTE employees did just a superhuman job in bringing back to life the electricity system in Michigan that had died as a result of that Northeast blackout.
We're talking to Tony Early. When we come back, we'll ask him about the employees of DTE. And I'm Jack Brasool, and this is Anything Is Possible on News Talk 760 WJR. This is Anything Is Possible. I'm your host, Jack Brasool, and with Tony Early, who worked for DTE from 94 to 2011 and rose to be its chairman and CEO. Tony, tell us about the DTE employees and the call center, those workers, the linemen, when a storm hits and there's a major power outage.
You know, DTE employees are just an underappreciated asset in the Detroit community. And I will say that it's true about my PG&E employees here in California, because when there is a major outage, a storm that comes through, an ice storm that comes through, they are incredibly committed to restoring power to our customers. The call center workers are there around the clock, linemen working 16-hour days. And think about this. Many times it's in bad weather, because that's what caused it, climbing poles in bad weather, handling 13,000-volt electricity. Is a very challenging, difficult job. And yet they will work day in and day out until every customer gets back. The other thing about DTE and other utilities is it's not only the folks that are out on the front lines. In a major incident like that, every employee steps up and has their second job that they take over in order to support the effort. So when companies bring in crews from out of state, those crews, they don't know the geography. They don't know where to get the equipment. And so we assign guides to those crews. And they could be an accountant. They could be an engineer that then kind of shepherds the crew around the service territory, gets them where they need to be, make sure they get fed, make sure they get all the equipment that they need. in order to do the job. One of the great stories that I can recall, the lawyer who is our general counsel of Detroit Edison used to go out and used to do what was called wire down duty. And he would be out there, and you've seen that yellow tape, but we always wanted to have employees there to warn people, particularly kids, away not to, to go near the wire, because the wire could be live and it was very dangerous. And we knew that a lot of the TV stations always wanted to interview our employees. And, of course, Tom, being a very seasoned lawyer and also very good on with the news media, we'd always kind of give his address as one of the places you might want to go visit where he is and talk to him. And he was terrific for us. But it underscores that no matter where you are in the company, you have a second job, and that is to get our customers back as soon as possible.
I quote you now. You say, this industry is the lifeblood of our economy. What do you mean by that?
Well, that is absolutely the case. Think of this. The energy industry, so the electric utility industry, the gas utility industry, our economy just doesn't operate without it. And every once in a while, you have an event that really brings that home to you. And so whether it's the Great Northeast Blackout of 2003, where I can remember driving home 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning to get a couple of hours sleep before I came back in, and the eerie feeling of seeing no lights whatsoever from downtown all the way up to Bloomfield Hills, and you realize that our economy grinds to a halt without that. Or natural gas. Occasionally there'll be shortages of natural gas because of cold weather. And I think just this past winter during the polar vortex, there were concerns that natural gas wouldn't be available to power plants and might not be available to residential customers. And you realize how vital it is to not only our economy, but also our way of life. Think of all the electric devices that each one of us plug in every day and never think about where that electricity is coming from to run that device. And so across the country, utility employees, utility executives really drive the economy of our country and the success of our country through the work that they do every single day.
Tony, in 2011, you became the chairman and CEO at Pacific Gas and Electric. Why did you take that job?
My wife, Sarah, has asked me that several times. I had stepped down at DTE Energy. I was very proud of the team that I put together there. Jerry Anderson, who's currently the CEO, had worked with me for almost 17 years. And I decided that he was ready to move up and run the company. And so I took the position as executive chairman. And as executive chairman, I did a lot of energy policy work in Washington, and I met with investors in New York. But day-to-day, Jerry was running the company, and it was a great relationship. We were really good partners in doing that. And I got this call from PG&E. In 2010, PG&E had a tragic gas explosion on a large high-pressure natural gas pipeline in San Bruno, California. Any of you have ever flown into the San Francisco airport, San Bruno is right adjacent to the airport. And in fact, the explosion was so bad that people had actually thought a plane had crashed about a mile from the airport. But it was a pipeline that had let go, burst into flames, and created just a real tragedy, loss of life, loss of houses. And the fellow who ran the company about 6 months after that stepped down, and the company went out looking for a new chairman and CEO. Now, throughout most of my career, PG&E was considered the gold standard of our industry. For the longest time, it was the largest company in our industry. We have 5.5 million electric customers here and over 4 million gas customers. To compare that with DT is about 2 million electric and 1.3 million gas, so more than twice the size of DTE Energy. But over the years, PG&E had not invested adequately in its infrastructure for a whole bunch of reasons that we don't have time to get into. And they needed really to rebuild not only their infrastructure, but the confidence of their constituents, the political constituency, the customer constituency. And it was an opportunity for me to take the skills that I had learned over almost 30 years in the industry and bring them to bear and hopefully bring PG&E back to the place that it was early on in my career, where it was considered one of the premier organizations in our industry. We've made great progress in the 3 years that I've been here, and it's hard to believe that it's already been 3 years. But we also acknowledge that we have a lot more to do to continue to move ourselves to where we want to be.
Tony, Will Rogers once famously said, "The coldest winter I ever spent was the summer I spent in San Francisco." Tell us about living in San Francisco.
Well, as Sarah says to me, it's not a hardship tour. We live right in the city. It is absolutely a beautiful city. It's got great restaurants. It's located near some fabulous natural resources. Golden Gate National Park, which straddles the Golden Gate Bridge, has fabulous hiking and mountains. So it's a wonderful place to live here, and it's been a great adventure for us. But you're absolutely right. The months of July and August are absolutely freezing in the city of San Francisco. As the air heats up over in the Central Valley, it sucks all of this cold air and clouds through the Golden Gate and freezes you to death. And what we enjoy seeing is all the tourists with their I Love San Francisco sweatshirts out walking around the street, because they came to California thinking they can get away with shorts and T-shirts, and they all have to go out and buy new clothing when they come here. So warning to those of you who ever want to visit San Francisco in the summer, make sure you dress warmly, because you will need it.
A story, if you will. Tony and Sarah lived across a pond on Charing Cross in Bloomfield Township. And every time it snowed, soon thereafter, there'd be areas shoveled off for kids to ice skate and play hockey. And one morning, I had to catch a real early flight, and I get in the car at 5 o'clock, and I'm driving past the pond. It's zero, blowing, snowing, and here's a man with a handheld snowblower, Tony Early. And I'm Jack Rasul, and this is Anything Is Possible on News Talk 760 WJR. I'm Jack Rasul. This is Anything Is Possible, and we're talking to Tony Early, who serves on the boards of Ford Motor Company and the Nuclear Energy Institute. Speaking of which, Tony, talk to us about nuclear power plants.
Well, I've been fortunate enough, Jack, to work in the nuclear power area since I graduated from Notre Dame. I went right from Notre Dame to U.S. Navy Nuclear Power School, and it is a great industry and a great technology. But before I talk about nuclear power plants, I should say that in the energy industry, one of the key issues is making sure that you have a diverse supply of power. There is no one answer. I mean, advocates for nuclear power think every power plant ought to be nuclear. Advocates for solar think the same thing. It's really like your investment portfolio. You've got to have diversity in your investments, because one year one segment will be up and the next year it will be down. A couple of years ago, Apple was a great investment, and then it crashed for a while, and now it's back up again. And the same is true with nuclear. And so in the 1960s and 70s, the U.S. went through a big expansion of the use of nuclear power, to where up until recently, about 20% of electricity generated in the United States came from nuclear power. A lot of people don't know how dependent we are on nuclear power. Then after the Three Mile Island accident in Chernobyl, the growth of nuclear in the U.S. came to a screaming halt. Just recently, we started to see a revival of nuclear power. There was talk about a nuclear renaissance. There are actually five nuclear plants under construction in the United States today. Unfortunately, that growth slowed down with the accident at Fukushima, which was caused by the earthquake and tsunami. So we're seeing an ups and downs. I hope that the five plants that are being built now are not the only ones. There are a couple of applications that are pending, and would love to see more nuclear plants built, because the reality is, if you really care about climate change issues and the amount of carbon dioxide being emitted into the atmosphere, then nuclear power has to be part of the energy mix. Nuclear power does not have any carbon dioxide emissions. And no matter how you run the numbers, unless we keep nuclear a viable option, you're not going to be able to reduce greenhouse gas emissions.
Tony, what's the future of coal-powered power plants?
So coal plants have done a tremendous job over the last 40 years in eliminating the traditional emissions sources, so sulfur dioxide, nitrous oxide, particulates. Unfortunately, there is no technology yet that's viable to take carbon dioxide out of the exhaust stream for coal-fired power plants. And while improvements in efficiency means you emit less CO2 for every megawatt of electricity that you generate, coal plants still are contributing to increased carbon in the atmosphere. So I think the strategy with coal plants has got to be we use the investment that we have in existing power plants. At the same time, continue to look for technologies that could remove carbon dioxide from the atmosphere. But until we find those technologies, I don't see that we're going to see a lot of new coal-powered plants built in the United States. Coal is still a very economic and attractive source of power, but it has its challenge from a greenhouse gas standpoint.
Tony, it's always been extremely important for you and Sarah to be very involved in the local community. Why?
Well, I think part of it goes back to my parents. Growing up, they were always involved in volunteer activities. One of my earliest memories, and I was probably 5 or 6 years old, and my dad volunteered. He was a coach in the Police Athletic League basketball league. And I think he was coaching either junior high school or high school students. I mean, as I said, I was only 5 or 6 years old. It wasn't like he was coaching me, and it wasn't like he was going to coach me anytime soon. But he loved doing that. And my mother was always involved in different volunteer activities. So you kind of get that in your DNA. But I've been fortunate enough to be in an industry where giving back to the community is absolutely part of what we do. Electric and gas utilities are uniquely tied to their communities because, unlike other companies, back when Detroit was really in the doldrums of the recession, I couldn't pick up and say, I'm going to move to Atlanta or I'm going to move to South Carolina because the economy is better there. Our success was tied to the success of the community. And so you have to make sure that the community is successful. And Sarah and I have been fortunate enough to be involved in a number of community activities that really makes us feel that we're contributing to the success of those communities.
And Sarah continues to be involved to this day with the Belle Isle Conservancy Initiative.
Yes, she just returned last night from Detroit, where they had their Belle Isle luncheon that was very successful, and she chairs the board there. And that's an organization that you watch as Belle Isle is being transformed. This is the 10th year that she's been doing it. She started the organization, and this is the 10th year they've had the fundraiser, the luncheon, and they're just going great guns there.
Speaking of continuing to be involved, you've been very involved for years with Cornerstone Schools in Clark Durant. Talk to us about Cornerstone Schools.
Cornerstone is a great institution for the city of Detroit. You know, it started over 20 years ago jointly by Cardinal Maida and Clark Durant. Clark is still working tirelessly to expand Cornerstone. In fact, in August, Clark and I and a number of others co-chaired a very successful fundraising event where we raised over $2 million for Cornerstone. And I had the privilege of announcing there that we have taken on the goal of expanding Cornerstone from educating just over 2,000 students in Detroit to 5,000 students over the next couple of years. And Cornerstone's record of educational success is unmatched in the city. In a city that has struggled educationally, 95% of Cornerstone graduates graduate from high school and go on to either colleges, technical schools, or the military. It's a great success story that not enough people know about.
Speaking of co-founded by Clark Durant and Cardinal Mita, I don't know which it's harder to do, to say no to Clark Durant or Cardinal Mita.
I've never figured out how to say no to either one of them.
I second that nomination. Tell us quickly about your leadership style, Tony.
Well, I would characterize it as what I've talked to my employees here as a servant leadership style. You know, there's the notion that when you become a high-up executive in an organization, everybody works for you, they should make you look good. The reality is a leader's job is to make his employees successful. And in a strange way, I actually learned this concept as a young officer in the Navy. Now, you'll say, Tony, that's nuts. I mean, talk about the quintessential command and control leadership style. It's the military. And yes, there are certain times when in the military you have to have a command and control style. When I was the officer of the deck on a nuclear submarine and I said left full rudder, a full dive on the stern planes, I didn't want the helmsman saying, don't you think standard rudder would be a little better than full rudder? No, I wanted them left full rudder. But most of the time, you have to rely on your employees to be successful. So as a young ensign coming onto a submarine, I knew all the theory of why the nuclear power system worked, but I couldn't repack a valve or overhaul a pump. That's what the crew knew how to do. And so my job was to make sure they had the resources, the parts, the equipment, in order to be successful. And so it's this notion of I serve them, and my job is to put in place the plans and the processes to help make them successful.
Last question. What advice would you give to our young listeners tonight?
You know, for our young listeners, I think they need to find something that they love to do and then learn to be best at that. I mean, do the best you can at what you really love to do. But at the same time, you need to be a lifelong learner. Be open to new ideas and new skills. Because I will tell you, in this rapidly changing world, you're going to change jobs multiple times in your career, and you need to embrace that change and not fight it.
Tony, talk about a true servant leader. Thanks much for all you do for all of America. Please keep it up.
Thank you, Jack.
Please join us next Sunday. Until then, I'm Jack Rasula. Thanks for listening, and make it a great week, because with God, anything is possible. Spohn.
Believe in yourself.